Today on Against the Grain, the world around us is increasingly toxic, with 90,000 registered chemicals in the U.S., most of which have never been tested for their effects on human health. While regulating and banning chemicals and other hazards is ultimately a key political question, my guest today, physician Ailey Cohen, argues that there's a fair amount we can do to protect ourselves. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. It's easy to imagine that if an everyday product contained toxic chemicals, for example, shampoo or food packaging, its sale would be illegal. Yet out of 90,000 chemicals in the U.S., only 5 have ever been banned. And each year, 1,000 more chemicals are added to the list without adequate data on their health effects. My guest argues that, given this dismal situation, we can and should take action to limit our exposure and that of those around us. Ailey Cohen is a board-certified rheumatologist and integrative medicine physician. With Frederick von Saal, who has done groundbreaking research on the hazards of bisphenol A, Cohen has written Non-Toxic, Guide to Living Healthy in a Chemical World. The book is published by Oxford University Press. When I spoke recently with Ailey Cohen, I asked her to begin by giving us a sense of the scope of toxic exposures that most of us face, even from quarters we don't expect.
Yeah, it's surprising just really how kind of polluted we are in almost every aspect of our lives. And cleaning products or personal care products that have ingredients, both of which have no formal regulatory oversight in terms of testing for safety or toxicity in those products. We have chemicals that are on our couches that, as Californians would know best, have been there from the 1970s and now no longer are mandated to be in our couches as, you know, methods to reduce exposure to fires, which actually don't work technically. But now, you know, it's up to the manufacturer to remove those chemicals. But we have chemicals, you know, really in a variety of other products, you know, be it stain guard chemicals, our cookware that people don't often think about. You know, still in fabrics like Gore-Tex and waterproofing chemicals. And then we have radiation, which we talk about in the book Non-Toxic as well, to give people an idea how to reduce those exposures as well.
And what happens to our bodies when our immune systems become overloaded by chemicals over time?
So the data is pretty robust on how many environmental chemicals now work. We've all heard about heavy metals in terms of neurotoxin activity, such as lead, and there's no safe level of lead, of course. But what's been discovered over the past, say, 15, 20 years is a really interesting body of literature, international now, and even with the, you know, along with the World Health Organization, position statements, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Endocrine Society, the American Academy of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, is that there's a class of chemicals within the 90,000 that we now know exist that are called endocrine disrupting chemicals. And so we know that not only can these chemicals affect the endocrine system in terms of the hormones and the signaling that goes on between hormones and organs and physiology, but we can also show that there's an inflammatory response to many of chemicals, including endocrine disruptors, that really set us up for a baseline elevation of inflammatory response, even just walking through life in modern day times. The reason that can be very concerning, especially now with coronavirus, is that we know that the inflammatory response to COVID is what's critical in terms of outcomes, whether or not people feel symptoms, whether or not people go on to needing oxygen or supplemental respiratory therapy, whether they go on to needing a respirator, and whether or not they go on to death. And part of the messaging, a big part of this messaging now, it turns out, is that if we reduce our environmental chemicals through our lifestyle, through diet, through drinking water contaminants, through personal care, cleaning products, fabric chemicals, If we rework on reducing those, then we're likely to reduce the inflammatory activity that they are associated with, and therefore, you know, reduce risk for a whole host of chronic conditions, as well as perhaps even a severe inflammatory response from COVID.
We'll return to COVID, but let me ask you about the long-term effects of having elevated inflammation. Over the past several decades, autoimmune diseases have been on the rise. Can a link be drawn between the increase in the toxic chemicals in our bodies and that increase in autoimmune diseases?
Yes, there's an association. It's very difficult to prove causation, as we know, for a variety of environmental exposures. But as a rheumatologist, I'm an integrative rheumatologist, and I study the immune system quite rigorously. You know, what we now see is that not only, as you mentioned, autoimmune disease has been on the rise over the past several decades. We now have 1% of the population that suffers with rheumatoid arthritis, and we have upwards of 10% of the population that suffers with some type of autoimmune disease. Now, the question is whether or not people, or I should say healthcare providers, are getting just much more savvy at detecting these diseases and diagnosing them much quicker or much earlier. Or is it really a question of our environment, which we now know in laboratory studies, in animal studies, that many of these environmental chemicals do increase a variety of inflammatory markers, such as IL-7, IL-6, natural killer cells, antibodies to a variety of exposures that we know can cause acute issues like asthma and exacerbations of COPD, but also low-level exposures over time, increasing risk for endocrine disruption, as well as the chronic diseases that are associated with endocrine disruption.
Ailey Cohen is my guest. She's a physician, a board-certified rheumatologist, and the author of Non-Toxic, Guide to Living Healthy in a Chemical World, published by Oxford University Press. Ailey, many of our listeners in the American West are now regularly contending with dangerous levels of smoke because of wildfires, something that's expected to recur each year. The fires, of course, put hazardous particulates into the air in great quantities, particulates that can do serious harm to the body. And the question of air quality is something that you write about in your book, and I wanted to ask you about what people can do, if anything, to protect themselves from polluted air outside, whether it's the kind of acutely dangerous air from fires or less acute but still significant exposures from other sources of pollution sullying our outdoor air.
Yeah, you know, this is something we tried to tackle, my co-author, Dr. Fred Von Saal, and I. We wanted people to understand both the indoor and outdoor difficulties, challenges, and actual solutions that we could come up with in order to reduce those exposures, which have changed so dramatically over the last several decades as well. In terms of the horrendous situation that's going on at West, I mean, I can only sympathize because we're on the East Coast and we don't see that kind of air pollution, at least, you know, to that degree. You know, we have our cities and we have our issues with, you know, combustion and automobiles, but nothing like what's going on with these fires and air quality. You know, the couple suggestions, you know, I'm sure many of your listeners already have thought about, you know, indoor changes in terms of air, you know, filters and systems. But outdoors, you know, we really want to think about whether or not it's a good time to go outside. I mean, as a physician, I have lots of patients with asthma and COPD and emphysema, and we really want to think about when are the best times to go outside. And so what we provided in the book is a lot of resources in terms of phone apps and websites to really get an idea of what the air quality is like before venturing out, if it's at all possible to control. We know with sunlight, you know, and protecting skin, that we often will tell patients, you know, healthcare providers will say, you know, try to remain out of the sun from, say, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. because that's when the rays are the most direct. And so I look at the air quality issues right now as a similar situation where if you are prepared, if you are given the right references, resources, apps, that you can really make more informed decisions as best you can given the circumstances.
You mentioned COVID not long ago, and I wanted to ask you if you could draw out for us the connection between air pollution and COVID, or making people more vulnerable to COVID.
Yeah, it turns out, I mean, we were all, you know, so worried about what was going on in the beginning that we didn't really have an idea of who was most affected and who would have the worst response. And it was just kind of an all, up in the air. And now we know a lot more information since this, you know, pandemic began and, you know, the beginning of the year. What we now know is that the more comorbidities or illnesses that a person has, the more likely they're going to have an increased inflammatory response to the coronavirus if they are infected. Now, everyone can get infected, as we know. It's not hard to get infected. Even household pets are getting infected. But what we understand now is that it's the person's baseline inflammatory levels that may contribute to a worse outcome. And so when it comes to people with comorbidities, they may or may not have been well controlled, say diabetes that is not well controlled, blood pressure is not well controlled. Certainly obesity is not something you can necessarily take care of overnight in terms of risk, but these are things that are worth considering because inflammation associated with comorbidities, whether it's the chicken or the egg, whether the inflammation from environmental exposures, which we know is real, contributed to the disorders such as obesity, diabetes being out of control, autoimmune disease, lung disease of any kind, or whether or not even having those conditions or even the medications used to treat those medications are contributing to the inflammatory baseline level. And so really, again, the message really is long-term, is to really start to think about how do we try to limit some of those environmental chemicals that are now pretty well studied internationally and nationally, to understand how they contribute to inflammation, the immune system's irritation, and why that kind of sets people up for worse outcomes if they are infected.
Clearly, people need to protect themselves from contracting the coronavirus. And while the virus mainly spreads through the air, it can also spread on surfaces. So, you know, it makes sense to take reasonable measures to disinfect them. But do you have any concern that in some places this is being taken too far with potentially unhealthy consequences through the excessive use of chemicals, especially as the weather cools in enclosed spaces? So kind of connecting that to the question of indoor air quality.
Yeah, this is a real challenge because, we know that disinfectant chemicals and products have been marketed, at an enormous amount over the last several months. And in fact, even with hand sanitizers, as we are now hearing about, is that many have been recalled. Upwards of 100 have been recalled because this push to market and throwing harmful chemicals in, such as methanol, as a filler. And so, we want people to be aware that there's resources in order to find out which are the safest chemicals for disinfectant. But what's really important, and something that my partner, Dr. Fred Vamsal, and I just wrote recently, was a paper on how to understand cleaning products, meaning when is it important to use cleaning products versus disinfectants? And there's a big reason to understand that because disinfectants often are stronger and they carry with them increased risk for potential harm. Whereas cleaning products, if they're vetted properly through environmental working groups, wonderful cleaning product website and resources, you can actually cut back on a lot of environmental chemicals, endocrine disruptors, colors, preservatives, and a whole host of chemicals that actually aren't even tested for safety or toxicity. I know California is moving in the direction to make sure that that is required on a cleaning product label. But for now, we really want to wade through the enormous number of products that are out there for cleaning and for disinfection and really know the difference. And so we do actually, in Non-Toxic, our book, we really do discuss that and give resources for the CDC's listings, environmental working groups listings, and also recipes on how to do safe non-toxic chemicals if people want to do it yourself. And so really that's a key issue as we move forward, especially in schools, especially around young people, and understanding when those chemicals are needed in which environments.
And that's Ailey Cohen, co-author of Non-Toxic, Guide to Living Healthy in a Chemical World, published by Oxford University Press. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you write in the book that there are particular times of life when the body is most vulnerable to the ill effects of toxic chemicals, although obviously they're not good for us at any time of life, but there are particular moments in life where that vulnerability increases. Can you take us through them?
Sure. So, you know, interestingly enough, you know, with these endocrine disrupting chemicals, as they, you know, there's about 1,000 that we now know out of the 90,000. I keep going back to the 90,000 because I think people really need to understand really how pervasive and ubiquitous these chemicals are and at the volume that there are at this point since the 1950s, post-World War II, it just exploded. And out of these 90,000, of course, third-party testing from universities and academic levels have found these endocrine disrupting chemicals in a variety of products. As I mentioned earlier, household cleaning products, you know, furniture products. And again, they work through disruption of the endocrine system, primarily through mimicking estrogen at very low levels, blocking androgens such as testosterone. And then, of course, we have other hormones in our body that are so critical. Thyroid hormone, which manages metabolism and certainly during pregnancy affects cognition and cognitive capability and development in a child's brain in utero. But we also want to think about, you know, the types of hormones that affect fertility, which is an ongoing issue, despite people's choices to perhaps start families later. We want to think about insulin, which is a hormone, and how that contributes to diabetes risk. Also, the hormones that affect obesity. So many endocrine disruptors have been shown to not only increase the likelihood of a stem cell in bone marrow to turn into a fat cell, but also increase the size of existing fat cells. So this all comes with inflammatory responses within at the cellular level. And we really just, it's just a question of how do we, you know, take this ubiquitous modern world that we live in and just chop back wherever we can. And hopefully this guidebook will give people a good pathway to do on their own at their own speed. It's a journey. I've been doing this for 8 years and I'm still learning. So it's just something for people to have as a resource and hopefully really dive in. The vulnerable areas of development that are so key tend to be times when endocrine growth and development is at its greatest, where we have enormous amounts of hormones being created, broken down, and transferred around the body. And those periods, as most of you would probably imagine, are in utero growth and development, where hormones are critical to create not only the physical parts of the body, but also the brain itself of a growing fetus. Then we have toddler years, which again is another period of enormous growth and development where hormones are the most active, perhaps even up to age 18. Teenage years, everyone listening who has a teenager may be very well aware of the raging hormones of teenage years. Of course, myself and many of us went through that as well. Certainly, that is a major time of growth and development of puberty, especially during adolescence as well. And then, of course, we have later years, menopause. People don't think much about menopause as being a great time of hormonal change, but it really quite, you know, it is. And so when you look at these different developmental moments of the human development, you know, from in utero all the way through, you know, menopause, you can see that because of the environment of endocrine change, that also opens this loophole of more response or effects from environmental chemicals that affect the endocrine system. And so we like to make people aware that if you can make some changes, that these are the periods that are most critical. Certainly pre-pregnancy and pregnancy is a critical time. And that understanding that it's not just what we're exposed to, but it's when we're exposed to it. And also understanding that the placenta itself doesn't always prove to be such a strong barrier to many of the environmental chemicals. In fact, in 2005, there was a study done by the Environmental Working Group that looked at 10 babies and their cord blood of newborns. And when they studied the newborn blood that, you know, the cord blood from the newborn when they came out, they found almost up to 200 industrial chemicals within cord blood itself. So I think it's pretty remarkable how we're exposed and the degree and what we have to do to work to reduce those levels.
Can you tell us about the particular vulnerability of children? You mentioned toddlers and teenagers, but how they are particularly vulnerable and how they differ from adults who have developed, as we age, more effective ways of ridding our bodies of chemicals. Why are children different, and what can be done to protect them given that particular vulnerability?
Yeah, this is a great question because, you know, we assume that sort of all humans can manage environment the same way because, you know, we all have skin and we all, you know, have livers and kidneys. But in fact, children are quite vulnerable because they do not have robust detoxification systems, particularly of the liver and particular enzymes. Stage two conjugation of the liver is really quite critical. And these are detox pathways that haven't been fully developed in many young children. In addition, by body mass index, pound for pound, children are just more exposed to many of the chemicals that are around us. Often they're on the floor, they're touching dust, which contains an enormous amount of environmental chemicals like phthalates and flame retardant chemicals and BPA that falls to the ground and then gets kind of balled up in dust. So toys that children play with are often, you know, layered with dust, as well as pets. And pets really are another interesting canary in the coal mine because we now know that pets are also not immune to the exposures of environmental chemicals, and it does cause them health conditions as well. But children have other, you know, unique properties about them that make them a little bit more worrisome when it comes to chemicals. They also do not have a consistent diet when it comes to green leafy vegetables and high quality fats like omega-3s. These are substances that we now know can help battle exposures. We know that it can help decrease the what we call methylation of DNA that can cause harm to our genome, essentially, from exposures over time. And so having a limited nutritional, I should say, palate and consistency of that palate as, you know, compared to adults, it also puts them a little bit behind the eight ball. So it's just one of those areas, if we can, you know, clean more, dust more, make sure that we're not buying products that we bring into the home that will become dust or fall into dust. These are just some of the ways we can really reduce those exposures, opening up windows when the air is actually better outside than indoors, not bringing candles, carpet powders, air fresheners, fabric softeners into the home will absolutely help to reduce those exposures where, you know, we spend most of our time now indoors in our homes.
Tell us about synthetic turf, because if you go to your average child's playground, you will often find ground tires or other synthetic materials as the cushioning of the playgrounds. What's the consequence of that kind of material being used in children's spaces?
Sports turf has really taken off over the past, you know, several, you know, decades because of its easy care. You know, it costs less to put down soccer turf or sports turf because it doesn't require in many ways much of the same maintenance that a well-manicured lawn does, which has its own issues as well, of course, with pesticides. But when it comes to sports turf, you know, there's a few issues to consider. Not only has there been increased numbers of physical injuries, we know more tears of the knees because of the kind of slipperiness of the synthetic plastic blades of grass. But we also know that many of these companies have been shown to have lead in the blades of grass, and especially at high heat. We know that can be troublesome because lead can actually aerosolize. And that's where people spend most of their time, is on the lower, you know, on the ground of turf. So that's one aspect. But we also know that tire crumb, which is basically chopped up tires, is used as filler in, you know, sports turf. And that can be made up of hundreds of harmful chemicals, not limited to benzene, fluoride compounds, or PFAS chemicals that are, you know, essentially waterproof chemicals, formaldehyde, and of course, lead. So, you know, the recommendations that I make, because I have two young boys and they love their sports, and I'm really not going to just tell them they can't do their sports. It's really a matter, like this book, you know, lays out, is how do we manage the world around us as best we can? And so some of the recommendations that we've made in the book are basically, you know, spending the least amount of time on synthetic turf as possible. And then when you come off, you know, washing with soap and water, because these are petroleum-based chemicals and made out of an oil base. So you really want to use detergents, you know, soaps, clean soaps. And really wash all over, not just, you know, the skin that's exposed, but also the skin that's not exposed in the socks, in the ears, and washing hair as well. If children have skin abrasions, then you certainly want to make sure they're covered up before playing on synthetic turf. And really keeping sneakers, cleats, anything that touches synthetic turf should really remain outside of the house. So having a bucket is what we have outside of our home for the types of clothing and shoes that gets in contact with synthetic turf. Washing animals or pets' paws after spending time on synthetic turf. And really discussing with your school, your daycare, really ways to go back to old school grass. And many, many places are actually converting back from expensive, shiny synthetic turf back to old school greenery and making it work with even reduced pesticides.
You mentioned leaving contaminated shoes at the door. Do you generally recommend that people take off their shoes before coming into the household as a way of keeping more than just turf out?
Yeah, I generally do, because it's not just turf that we're talking about in terms of the bottoms of our feet. We're really talking about, you know, pesticides from our lawns. If we can cut back on our lawn spraying, that would be great too, but we can't always control for that. I myself live in New Jersey. We're up against 200 acres of preserved farmland that's farmed by our local farmers that use glyphosate. So we already know that we're going to be tracking that into our home if we don't take our shoes off, even at a very microscopic level, you know, parts per million, parts per trillion. But we have chemicals from roads, and we have chemicals from even bathrooms that we go in and out of. So, you know, a general recommendation would be to try to keep your shoes either outside or, you know, in a bucket, or even in the front doorway when you come in, because that's where we're at with our family. We basically open the door and we have sort of this area of contamination that, you know, we just unload our shoes into a bucket or right in that space. But it's not a perfect situation. And, you know, we don't always get it right, of course, but we do the best we can. And that seems to be a pretty reasonable recommendation.
And that is physician Ailey Cohen, co-author with Frederick Von Saal of Non-Toxic, Guide to Living Healthy in a Chemical World, published by Oxford University Press. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. So, Ailey, I wanted to ask you about food packaging. I think a lot of our listeners are very aware of the issues connected to chemicals in food, the use of pesticides and herbicides on food. But I think much less attention has been paid to the food packaging that touches your food and the consequences of, you know, buying perhaps your organic seaweed packaged in a particular packaging.
Yeah, it's kind of a sad irony when you're going for organic products and they've been moved from glass into, BPA containing or phthalate containing plastic packaging. And I think it's getting harder and harder to find those glass foods. And, you know, it's a challenge, but it is the reality we live in. What I often will say is, even for hot foods that we pick up, if we do takeout, and, you know, many people rely on takeout, especially now, to really transfer your food as quickly as possible from a hot plastic into something that has a stronger matrix, such as stainless steel or glass. We actually worked out with our favorite Indian food restaurant that I would bring my large stainless steel container, which is really a camping container that's entirely stainless steel on the interior, and to bring it, and they put in their, you know, three orders of our favorite tikka masala. But it's our favorite meal, and that's how we handle it, and they've been very kind about it. So the idea that you can discuss this with people, and even though it may sound crazy to begin with, now it's normal, is one way to handle that, especially for takeout. But you know, there are particular concerns, of course, over food packaging, specifically BPA in canned foods. Bisphenol A is a really important chemical that has been around since the 1930s. And actually, what's important about BPA is it's one of the world's highest volume industrial chemicals, and it has an annual production of about 20 billion pounds. So it's pretty much in a lot of things, but specifically in terms of food packaging, it's in the inner lining of cans, be it soda cans or just regular canned food. And it's a plastic lining, an epoxy resin that basically was designed to protect the contents of those cans from the metal wall of the container. Now, the problem with BPA is in 1936, it was actually found to be very estrogenic. I mean, it's made from petroleum, but it turns out it has estrogenic effects and actually was considered to be used for as a fertility drug. But they came up with a better option at that time, like DES. So at that time, it was, you know, switched, you know, in terms of whether they used it for packaging materials versus even in medicinals. So what happened with BPA is it became so pervasive and so flexible in its ability to bend and also to be hard as well. So it was useful in a lot of different products that we now live and work around. Bisphenol A was found actually in large part by the work of my co-author, Dr. Frederick von Saal, and his colleagues nationally and internationally, to have these estrogenic effects about 20 years ago in the foods that we use in terms of their packaging. And so it has become really well known now at this point that BPA was taken out of plastic baby bottles in 2012, due to much of the research that Dr. von Saal contributed to. But it's still out there. It's still in our food packaging. It's in a whole variety of, you know, it's on pocketbooks to make them, as a coating. It's on top of receipts. All currency worldwide has BPA to set the ink, receipts in this country as well. So there is dermal exposure to BPA through the skin from touching receipts, and there's studies to show that, and they measure that in the urine of those exposed. And so one of the recommendations, and we give many of them, of course, we talk about the history and the poor regulatory aspects of many of these chemicals, but we talk about the solutions of how to handle BPA. And one of them is to see if you can transfer your shopping to frozens that perhaps are in plastic but are not necessarily heated in plastic, that don't have necessarily BPA in that plastic. And, you know, reducing canned foods can actually dramatically reduce exposure to bisphenol A or BPA. In fact, it has a half-life of 6 hours. So if you really do a great job of reducing that exposure, you'll see a difference. It's been shown to reduce that in the urine of study participants, human study participants. Other simple choices and changes we can make is to reduce receipts, you know, taking receipts in, you know, by hand and having them just emailed to us, or having an envelope that's specifically meant for receipts and not touching them. But washing your hands after touching receipts as well is really quite important because we have hand-to-mouth exposure even as adults. So those are just some of the recommendations we make, and there's a whole host of others. But food packaging has become an issue from phthalate exposure and BPA. Metals can get into food packaging. So we have to work pretty hard to either make our own food, package our own food, or just be really, you know, able to navigate these waters, which we try to do in our book.
Well, what about paper wrappings? People may feel like if they get their food in a cardboard box, or if it's wrapped in a piece of paper, that's going to be better because they're not going to be using plastic. And of course, that stuff also goes into the landfill and is a problem for all sorts of other reasons. But what are the issues that come up with cardboard and paper?
Yeah, this is a wonderful question because it's making a lot of news now, is the perfluoroalkyls or the PFAS chemicals. There's a whole set of chemicals that are added, or I should say lining, many paper materials because it makes them grease proof. So think, you know, fast food restaurants, they have a coating on the wrappers that prevent grease from sinking through and causing a whole bunch of problems with the wrapper itself. So, and there's been studies that show that actually some of the highest levels in our bodies of these grease-proofing chemicals, PFAS chemicals, are in those who consume a large amount of processed foods from these types of restaurants. But PFAS chemicals are getting in a whole bunch of other areas of our lives, be it contaminated drinking water. Certainly, it's getting into our lakes, streams, and runoff that goes to our wastewater management plants that it actually isn't washed off in terms of those plants and their infrastructure. But, you know, in terms of papered goods, you know, there's something that's going to either coat it in order to keep it from being greaseproof or waterproof. And we also have Tetra Paks, of course, that are cartons that hold soup now, and they hold, you know, of course, milk and a variety of other beverages. Tetra Paks are lined typically with plastic. Usually it's a terephthalate or a number one with a triangle. And so that's the type of plastic that goes on the inside of cartons. And of course, exposing yourself to that, you know, over periods of time is very similar to plastic bottle exposure. And we want to reduce that as much as we can and look for alternative sources for those foods.
Let me ask you about radiation in the household. Something that, again, may not be something we're thinking a lot about. What are the sources and what are the risks?
So radiation is obviously a big deal now, more so than ever, because we have, you know, we're quarantined. We're home. We're using computers around the clock now for remote learning, for business, for resources. So radiation, or EMF radiation, is something that we can all control a little bit better, or I should say safer. And that's the whole point of the chapter, is not so much to say people should cut back or get rid of, although that's always a good idea in terms of mental health and social media, but really also, you know, we can control how much radiation hits our bodies, and especially our children's bodies and their skulls, if they're using phones, for instance, cell phones. You know, radiation is essentially the connection that goes between a cell phone, for instance, or a laptop and a cell phone tower. And it's a pulsing radiation, it's electromagnetic radiation, similar to a microwave. It's a microwave range in terms of spectrum. But over time, that can cause some issues. And we know this now from exposures in animal studies as well as human studies, particularly cell phones that are held in the front pockets of your pants. Not only has it been associated with decreased sperm quality, but sperm quantity, and can contribute to fertility long term. So that's one concern. Also, young women, adult women even, carry their cell phones in their bras often. And there have been findings of not only benign, but also cancerous tumors, specifically underneath the antenna of the cell phone, where the phone sits. And so this is being looked at much deeper level with the NIH. I believe they have an ongoing study. So radiation is something that, even if it doesn't cause you to have heat at that location of your skin, can still be a radiation connection. And we really want to think about how to not rely on the heat being a warning sign for exposure, but to also know that this is going on without raising the temperature of the skin's surface. I often walk around my kids' school, at least I did, you know, several months ago, and all the kids had their laptops on their lap, when in fact laptops are a source of radiation, especially when they get heated up, and really should be at least, you know, 1 to 2 feet away from vulnerable parts of the body, such as the groin, such as the breasts. And for those with pacemakers, certainly you don't want to keep cell phones or radiation in and around the front chest pockets.
I would like to ask you about noise pollution, which you write about in the book, but it's not something that I think most people realize has an effect on our physical health. Can you tell us about the connection?
Yeah, noise pollution is something that really people don't pay attention to, especially if you're immune to it. If you're living in cities, you know, you've kind of been desensitized to the loud alarms or ambulances or just shouting at the next apartment. But what's been shown is that noise pollution is an environmental exposure, just like synthetic light, just like stress. And so we talk a little bit about that in the book to give people an idea that even living near airports, studies have shown people have higher rates of heart disease and cardiac conditions. And it's been tested in several good studies, not just in the United States, but also in Europe. So I think it's something to think about as we, you know, stay indoors and we're surrounded by lots of noise of other people. Not always can we get away from it. We want to consider how we handle that noise, which can actually increase stress levels. And there's a lot of really great ways to do that. We talk about different materials in building materials. We talk about noise reducing fabrics that can be used in and around spaces. Certainly being mindful that it actually is an issue and taking the time to turn off televisions, turn off, you know, things we can control within the home or workspace. And then, of course, getting out to nature and places where there is reduced exposure to noise is a wonderful way, not just only for prevention of heart disease and heart conditions and elevated blood pressure, but also really for mental health, which is so key right now.
Well, people are not really doing much of this right now because of the coronavirus, but one of the things that a lot of people do for their health is going to the gym. And I wanted to ask you about the ubiquity of substances like vinyl or PVC, one of the most toxic of the plastics, in so much exercise equipment, from yoga mats to exercise machines to padding. Why is it so dangerous, and what can we do about it?
Yeah, it's just because it's a cheap material and it can be made in bulk worldwide. So there's no regulatory constraints to any of the chemicals that are in the plastics that we touch, and in many of the chemicals, as I mentioned, in our food products and personal care. There's literally no regulatory management or testing. And so when it comes to the gym, for instance, or even our iPhone cases, I mean, those can often be made from plastics that can be absorbed through the skin, certainly not as readily as perhaps even food contaminants, but can actually do that. But I made a point, because I like to go to the gym, did like to go to the gym. Now I go outside and do my exercise outdoors. But we really just want to do similar activities that we would with synthetic sports turf. We want to really make sure we don't have open wounds when we're touching these mats and the handles of a lot of gym equipment. We want to wash down with, a soap that can break through petroleum-based chemicals. Certainly in terms of infectious risk, we want to think about isopropyl alcohol or some type of disinfectant that's less harmful that we can take on the go. I often, interestingly enough, when I was going to the gyms, I would often really just be beside myself when I was in the showers looking at the available shampoo, conditioners, and body washes that were for free in the showers. And I thought to myself, I just spent an hour working out and sweating and detoxing using our natural physiology. And here I am in a shower about to put all these chemicals back into my body through dermal exposure to chemicals in all of these personal care, which I'm sure were not vetted because they're, kind of put in these big vats for the gym members. So I think it's important to bring your own products and kind of know what you're going to be using in your shower, especially the antibacterial chemicals, which we know are endocrine disruptors, like triclosan, are still in many products, even if they're not in liquid hand soaps, which they were removed in 2016. But they're in a variety of other things, particularly yoga mats, believe it or not, and cookware. So understanding your products, don't getting bought by the antimicrobial marketing, which is actually not a great thing. For everyday bacteria, we want to not reduce our microbiomes on our skin, in our bodies.
Another question for a post-COVID world. People are not flying much now, but when they do, again, what about water on airplanes? When you're on an airplane, you get the airplane's water in tea or coffee in ice cubes. You don't get it in the bottled water necessarily. That has its own problems. But why do you flag water on airplanes as something to be avoided?
Yeah, well, this was a wonderful study that just came out, in 2019 that really looked and ranked some of the dirtiest water in airplanes. Essentially, airplane water doesn't have to be tested either often or regularly. And if it does, it's really done at a monthly level. And it's one of those things where people aren't paying attention and those tanks are often not cleaned as well. And so there was a great study that showed, and we talk about this in the book, that in 2019, found that the EPA, one of the federal agencies responsible for ensuring, safe aircraft drinking water, really wasn't even not just, ensuring and overseeing a lot of the water contaminants that are in on airplanes, but also really not serving any penalties for any violations as well. My recommendation, given that the water that's used in the tanks on airplanes are also used for making coffee for passengers, for washing your hands in the bathroom, is to really avoid that as much as possible. Bring your own, if you have to, bottled water or glass, water in glass. But to try to avoid exposure in airplanes because of the oversight is so poor, and then it can have not just chemicals in these tanks, but also bacteria. And so you want to be careful even washing your hands in the bathroom, perhaps bring a sanitizer that's vetted instead of actually being exposed in bathroom water on airplanes.
Let me end by asking you if there's anything we can credibly do to reduce levels of chemicals that are already in us. Popular press will put forward things about flushing toxins out of your body, but Are there evidence-based means to actually reduce levels of chemicals beyond reducing one's exposure, or in addition to reducing one's own exposure?
Yeah, well, the first thing I always recommend to everyone is if you stop buying products that have these chemicals, if you stop bringing them into your home, if you clean up the diet a little bit from processed food chemicals that are, you know, obviously whole foods are better because they don't have the, you know, the chemicals for mouthfeel to make it crunchy, or preservatives, coloring emulsifiers to make them feel very smooth and creamy. There's just an enormous amount of contaminants in food, in water, getting a water filter. If you don't bring them into your home, you know, products, and you tweak your diet and your water, you can actually reduce those levels enormously. In addition to that, we have been evolving for over 4.5 million years, and we have the ability to sweat out many of the chemicals. They can, you know, be found on skin surfaces. Several studies that we pointed to in our book. What we're hoping that people will do is embrace some of our physiology that we've evolved with for, you know, 4.5 million years, and understand that these chemicals have only been in our lives for the last 200 years. And that includes medications, which we actually have a whole chapter on medications and how they are, you know, the pros and cons and what the issues of some major classes are. We want people to think about harnessing the body's natural ability to detox through sweating, whether it's aerobic exercise or it's a sauna for those like many of my patients who are arthritic and can't actually go run a mile due to arthritis of the knees and back. So an old-fashioned sauna would be just reasonable to help wash out those chemicals. But other things, like a study that was performed in 2013, and we now have several studies after that showing that the brain itself has what's called a glymphatic system, which is fluid around the brain that helps wash chemicals out from around the brain during sleep. And so sleep is not just to give you better cognition and improve memory and to feel comfortable and awake, but it's also really a mechanism for detoxing that many people don't even know about. And so we talk about all these different natural ways to detox that don't require fancy diets or, you know, special cleanses. We talk about recipes that, you know, harness the body's detox ability through food quality. Cruciferous vegetables are incredibly detoxifying. And, you know, we can get those in so many different ways through shakes that are low in sugar, through our food choices. And so, again, we go through as many different ways for everyday people to harness the detox properties that are in their body, and then how they choose their food properly to help harness those as well. And hopefully people will be able to, you know, jump on board, because, again, this book is not meant for people who have tons of money or who are, you know, well-versed in all the sciences, especially toxicology. It's really meant to get to everyone at every level to have choices. In addition to the book, we are hoping that people who may, you know, not want to sit down right now and just read the book all at once or in pieces, but to really explore The Smart Human is the platform that I've set up to give people nuggets of really important environmental health and disease prevention information Monday, Wednesday, Friday on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or thesmarthuman.com. And we don't endorse or brand anything, so it's really squeaky clean, and people can get an ongoing feed for making those changes at their own pace.
Ailey Cohen, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Ailey Cohen is a physician, a board-certified rheumatologist, and co-author with Frederick Vom Saal of Non-Toxic, Guide to Living Healthy in a Chemical World, and that's published by Oxford University Press. At againstthegrain.org, you can find a link to that book. She's also the co-editor of the textbook, Integrative Environmental Medicine, and her website is thesmarthuman.com. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.